Now, we are in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, and if you were to characterize Ecclesiastes chapter 10, it's all about making wise choices. That's essentially what the whole chapter is about. If you think about the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon went to considerable length to establish that you're not going to find happiness outside of God. You're not going to find happiness apart from God. He tried, and it left him with despair to the point that he hated life. And so he had an existential crisis, and he shared that in the book of Ecclesiastes so that you don't have to go there. You don't have to try to spend your life trying to find happiness where it'll never be found apart from God. But now that he's established that, now he wants to give us some wisdom on how to handle the storms of life, how to get through life, because we live in a broken world. And one of the areas that he's going to talk about is our choices. Sometimes small choices have large outcomes, for good or for bad. For good, sometimes the smallest step in the right direction is the biggest step you'll take in your whole life. So small choices can have large outcomes, and that's what Psalm's going to be talking to us about. When I think about choices, I think about Benjamin Franklin's statement, "We stand at the crossroads each minute, each hour, each day, making choices. We choose the thoughts that we allow ourselves to think, the passions we allow ourselves to feel, and the actions we allow ourselves to perform. Each choice is made in the context of whatever value system we've selected to govern our lives. In selecting that value system, we are, in a very real way, making the most important choice we will ever make." Remember, Joshua says, you choose what you're going to do. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. He chose his value system. And now all other choices are now going to be made in the choice of that value system. The value system of truth. The value system of what's right, God's word. And so what value system will you choose? And it seems like a small choice because it's one choice. It's just one choice out of millions of choices you're going to make in your life. This is only one. And yet that one choice determines your destiny. One choice determining your destiny. That's how small choices can have big outcomes. And this is what Jesus meant when he said, one man built his house on the sand, and the storms came, and it didn't stand. But another man built his house on the rock. In other words, it withstood the storms of life because he chose the right value system to build on, the rock of truth, the rock of Christ. So this is what Solomon's going to be talking to us about, and we're just going to look at seven areas we need to choose wisely. And the first one is, one small choice can have big outcomes. Look at in chapter 1, I've put some of these passages on the screen in different translations. This is the New Living Translation paraphrase. "As dead flies cause even a bottle of perfume to stink, so a little foolishness spoils great wisdom and honor." This is talking about small things having large outcomes. One small choice can ruin a good reputation, for example. One sin can destroy much good, he said in chapter 9. One bad apple can spoil the whole barrel. Isn't that a saying that we grew up with? And so the Bible is full of these small choices that have large outcomes. For example, Esau. Esau sells his birthright for a bowl of porridge. That was a small choice, but it had vast repercussions. Moses was not allowed to enter the promised land. You remember that? Over one choice. He got frustrated, and he struck the rock. And God had commanded him to speak to the rock. But he wanted to show the people, you know, but that one choice, he wasn't allowed to enter the promised land. Aaron helped the people build a golden calf. And so this it's with us today. Sometimes small choices can have large outcomes. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Sometimes we act or react without thinking. And Viktor Frankl went through the concentration camps of World War II. He was in the Nazi camps. He was Jewish. And he came to this realization that they could take everything from him. And they literally did. They took everything from him, including his wife. But they could not take his own free will. They could not take away his choice on how to respond within himself. They could not take that away. And so he said that between stimulus and response, between action and reaction, there's a space in there. And in that space is your free will to choose how to respond. And you have freedom there. You have the freedom to choose. Here's what you don't have the freedom of. You don't have freedom from the consequences of your choice. So you have the freedom to choose, but you don't have the freedom to escape the consequences of your choice. And so this is where Solomon is going to ask, you know, what direction are you going in life? Verse 2 and 3, a wise person chooses the right road. A fool takes the wrong one. You can identify fools just by the way they walk down the street. New Living Translation paraphrase. What direction are you going in life? It's like a plane that's off course only 1 degree. 1 degree doesn't seem like very much. But when a plane is off course 1 degree, by the time you go out 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 miles, that separation gets wider and wider and wider because you're only off by 1 degree. But over time, that 1 degree difference is all it took to be 100 miles off course. So that's how a small choice can have a large impact. What direction are you going in life? This is where Solomon is causing us to think about our decisions, our choices. Margaret Thatcher says, "Watch your thoughts, for they become words. Watch your words, for they become actions. Watch your actions, for they become habits. Watch your habits, for they become your character. And watch your character, for it becomes your destiny." It starts so small. So small. It's like, I'm going to give myself a pass, you know, in this one area. I'm just going to be a little selfish in this one area. Just that 1 degree off. And 10 years down the road, that 1 degree, way off course. And so, I think about Abraham and Lot. You know, Abraham's servants and Lot's servants are fighting because there's limited pasture land and they've got big flocks. They're blessed. Isn't that funny that Lot's flocks were blessed, Abraham's flocks are blessed, so let's fight. Sometimes the more blessings, the more we're going to fight. And that's what happened with Abraham and Lot. And so the servants are fighting because there's limited resources. And so Lot and Abraham realize they need to talk this out. And so Abraham tells Lot, "You choose. You choose where you want to go." And I always thought, wait a minute, Abraham, you're the patriarch. What are you giving your nephew the choice? You should have first choice. If you're Abraham, you received the promise. You're the patriarch of the family, but you're going to give Lot the first choice? It dawned on me why. Because Abraham's going to follow the Lord regardless. It doesn't matter what Lot does. Lot, you make the choice of what's best for you. I'm going to follow the Lord regardless. Your decision has no bearing on me. I'm going to follow the Lord either way. I mean, and then it makes sense. It makes sense. Lot did make the first choice, and he looks down into the lower plain down near Sodom, and he sees, wow, if I'm going to get rich, it's probably going to be down there. That's the best pasture land. That's the best real estate. That's where I want to be. That was one choice. One choice, which was the beginning of the end of Lot and his family, basically. Just one choice is all it was. And I love that Abraham gave him the first choice, because it's Abraham's going to serve the Lord regardless of what Lot chooses. So it really doesn't matter who chooses first. The point is to choose wisely, because small choices can have large outcomes. That's number one. Number two, guard against overreacting. Look at verse 4. If a ruler rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness can lay great offenses to rest. That's the NIV. So where we need to make wise choices is we need to guard against overreacting. Here's a ruler who gets angry at you. You've got a choice between stimulus and response is a space. And in that space is your free choice. How are you going to respond? Are you going to overreact? Are you going to quit your job because you got mad? Or somebody didn't treat you right? He's saying, don't overreact. What does he say? Calmness can lay great offenses to rest. So, even after we choose the right value system, we're still going to face difficulties, you know? And that means on the job as well. The New Living Translation sort of puts this in the context of work. If your boss is angry at you, don't quit. A quiet spirit can overcome even great mistakes. When I was in my early 20s, 1920, something like that, I got a job at Kmart. And so I worked at Kmart in the summers. And a couple of my buddies, they were looking for work, and I said, well, come over to Kmart. So we all three worked at Kmart. I was in home improvement, and they were in garden center, and we all got our forklift license, so we could operate the forklift. And in the summertime, the garden center employees had to place these big pallets of soda in the front, and they stacked these pallets of soda in front of Kmart. You know, so you're walking in, and you see just walls of soda. And so the big boss is there, and my friend, it's his turn to load the forklift of this massive pallet of soda. And the boss is watching him. And this is the big boss. He's the boss of the whole Kmart. And he's in his suit and tie. And he's making my friend nervous. Okay, because the boss is watching. And now he's trying to operate this forklift. So the boss is standing there. And he's supposed to come in and load this. Well, he comes in too high. And he jams the forks through the whole bottom half of all the soda cans. And soda just sprays everywhere. And it just soaked the boss. And we're talking soda in the face, all on his tie. And my friend standing, sitting there with a forklift like, what do I do? And the boss just looks down. He's just dripping in soda. And he just glares at him. And he just walks away. I wished I could have been there to see the whole thing. And my friend wishes he wasn't there, because he saw the whole thing. It was his fault. Well, we laughed about it a lot later. He didn't get fired. You know, it was a mistake. And people make mistakes. It just happened to be a really funny mistake if you knew our boss. He didn't take it very well. Don't overreact when your boss gets mad. The Life Application Study Bible says, employees should write out the temper tantrums of their employer. Write it out. If we quietly do our work and don't get upset, the employer will probably get over his anger or her anger and calm down. This is just life, okay? And the point is that a mistake was made. You embarrassed the boss in front of everybody. But that doesn't mean you should overreact and walk off the job or quit or whatever. Guard against overreacting. And that's not just on the job. Think about in the home. Sometimes parents get harsh with their kids. Sometimes parents have harsh words for their children. The children should not run away. They shouldn't run away just because mom or dad got upset. That would be an overreaction. And likewise, a husband might have harsh words for his wife, or a wife has harsh words for her husband. It happens. That doesn't mean you should just leave. It just means that this is life. It means that calmness can lay great offenses to rest. I remember when Lisa and I had moved into the place we're in now, it had problem after problem that had to be fixed. And one Saturday morning, I'm out there, and it's hot sun. You know, it's really getting hot, and I'm out there just grumbling, and I'm upset, and I'm mad, trying to fix this and fix that, and nothing's working. And I just got a short fuse that morning. And Lisa says, "When was the last time you ate?" I was like, oh, "I'm on an empty stomach. My blood sugar is crashing, and I'm overheating, and I'm mad. I was hungry. I was hangry. Is that what they call it?" Well, I was so thankful that she asked that question. She could have taken it personally because I was being rude. I was not being very nice. But what does it say? A quiet spirit can overcome even great mistakes. A husband and a wife can know one another enough to know something's wrong. They're upset, but uncharacteristically upset. There's something else going on. So guard against overreacting. Also, Solomon says, when making wise choices, don't put your faith in worldly rulers. There is another evil I've seen under the sun. Kings and rulers make a grave mistake when they give great authority to foolish people and low positions to people of proven worth. I have even seen servants riding horseback like princes and princes walking like servants. I'm using paraphrase on chapter 10 because it just helps get to the point faster. And that is, rulers are flawed people, and they're going to disappoint you. And what happens is, worldly rulers, they surround themselves with fake people, attracted to power. And what happens is, friends of the ruler are usually the people who helped get him into his position of power. And so now, he's obligated to hire his friends for positions of authority and power. And this is, unfortunately, the way the game is played. And so what happens is, these people who don't care about anybody but themselves end up in positions of authority and take advantage of it. And that's essentially what Solomon is talking about. Think about Haman. Haman was a status seeker, and he was not qualified to be anywhere near the levers of power. But he worked his way up, as often happens, in the court of Xerxes, the king of Persia. And the king was impressed with Haman. Okay? And so he placed Haman above all the other officials. And of course it went to his head, because Haman was so full of himself. And so people were supposed to bow to Haman. And everybody's bowing to Haman because of his rank. Except for one guy refuses to bow. And his name is Mordecai. And it happens to be Esther's uncle. He refuses to bow. And so as Haman comes across on his horse, you know, riding on his high horse, everyone's bowing and Haman's just standing there. And you can bet Haman noticed. And somebody asked, you know, Mordecai about it. And he said, "I'm not going to do it." So Haman began to hate Mordecai. In fact, it got so bad that he begins plotting to kill Mordecai. And he even begins building a gallows to have Mordecai hanged. So, in the meantime, though, Mordecai uncovers a plot that was unfolding in the palace guard he'd heard about. And he informed the king's officials that there's a plot against the king's life. They investigated and found out it was true. There were some high officials in the court, some bodyguards who were going to take the king out. and they arrested him. Well, nothing ever happened about it, you know. And one night the king can't sleep. And so he asks for the record, the royal record, to be read to him. And as they're reading to him, they come across this plot that was uncovered by Mordecai. And he says, well, whatever, what did we ever do for Mordecai? And they said, nothing. We didn't do, nothing was ever done for Mordecai. And he says, well, who's in the palace right now? And they said, Haman. Haman happened to just be walking in. And he says, have Haman come in. And Haman comes in before the king and he says, Haman, how shall I honor a citizen that I want to honor in my kingdom? And Haman instantly thinks he's talking about him. Right? Because that's the way Haman thinks. Everything's about me. And so Haman, you can just see his eyes light up and the wheels start to turn because he thinks the king wants to honor Haman. And so he says, okay, here's what you do. You take the king's royal robe and you put it on him and you place this man on the king's horse and then you parade this man through the streets. And the person parading this man through the streets is going to proclaim to everybody, this is what the king does to those he wants to honor. And the king says, that's a great idea. I want you to do that for Mordecai. Haman thought he was talking about him. He wanted to honor Mordecai. And now Haman has to bring Mordecai through the streets and proclaim how this is how the king honors the person he wants to honor in his kingdom. Well, you know what ended up happening. Total humiliation. And Haman's not going to put up with it. And he manipulates, let's say, the king into signing a decree to kill not just Mordecai, but all of the Jews. Because Mordecai was Jewish. And this is where Queen Esther ends up having to make a very difficult decision on how to explain to the king, you were totally set up. You know, Mark Twain said it's easier to fool somebody than to tell them that they've been fooled. So Queen Esther is going to have to actually tell the king, you were totally had. You were set up. You didn't even see it coming. But she has to put it in a much nicer way. And he figured it out. And Haman was hung on the very gallows that he built for Mordecai. Think about it. Don't put your faith in worldly rulers. Don't put your faith in the power or the rule or people. Put your faith in God, who causes rulers to rise and fall. Be still and know that God is in control. There's another area here we have to watch, and that is don't be overconfident, think ahead. This explains the strange section of Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. If a snake bites before it's charmed, the charmer receives no fee. What's Solomon talking about here? He's talking about don't be overconfident in your work. You need to think ahead. And costly mistakes happen when we're overconfident. You know, pride goes before the fall. That's what that means. And we think of these work axioms, don't we? Don't paint yourself in a corner. That's a work axiom, but it applies to life. Don't paint yourself in a corner. You're going to have to walk over your wet paint to get out. Don't cut the branch you're standing on. Right? Work smarter, not harder. These are work axioms. Pride goes before a fall. So this is what Solomon's talking about. Don't be overconfident. Think ahead. And that's not just in work, it's in life. Think ahead in life. Because whatever we apply these to, whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Sometimes People will dig a pit for their enemy, but they fall into the pit that they dug for them. Sometimes somebody builds a gallows to hang their enemy. They end up hung on the very gallows they were building for them. So Jesus says, they are blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind leads the blind, both will fall into the ditch. So this is about life, too. It's not just about work. Don't be led by blind leaders like the Pharisees. If the blind leads the blind, both will fall into the ditch. So it applies to work. It applies to life. And if you break through a wall, a serpent might bite you. Look what else a serpent is likened to. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. What are we talking about? Don't be overconfident in life. Don't think that you can play with fire, you're not going to get burned. Overconfidence invites problems. Overconfidence invites addiction. And here's how it works. Just one more drink. Just one more drink with friends. Just one more for the road. Just one more click on the internet. Just one more lie. I'm not going to do it again. Just one more painkiller. Just one more angry swear word to get my way. Just one more. Just one more. And when you see somebody walking down the street mumbling to themselves, you knew they took it one too far, right? You see people that are just burned out on the street and they're arguing with themselves, you know they took it too far. And when you see a husband who's lost his wife and his kids, what did he do? He took it too far. Don't be overconfident. You know, think ahead is the whole point. And the worst is some are so overconfident that they don't need God. Imagine being so overconfident that I don't need God. I can do this by myself. I don't need God. I just need me. Pride goes before the fall. There's another area, and that is don't believe everything people say. In verse 12, the words of the wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. Talking about foolish speech and don't believe everything people say, it's kind of like this proverb. Fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. Isn't that amazing? Fools, they don't care about actually understanding. They only care about just airing their opinions, just telling everybody what they think. Well, don't believe everything people say. There are people who think the universe is out of balance until they give their opinion. And then somehow the universe comes back into balance and everything is whole now that I've given my opinion. Now we can all go on with our lives. I've had the final say. This proverb always cracked me up. The lazy man says, there's a lion outside. I'll be slain in the streets. I always wondered, what is this proverb talking about? Well, notice it's a lazy man who's saying it. And what is he saying? He's saying, there's a lion outside. I could be killed if I go outside. What's going on here? Well, don't believe everything people say. If somebody wants an excuse not to do something, any excuse will do. I only have to convince myself, right? So, if I don't want to go outside, this excuse will do. There's a lion out there. I could be killed. I can't leave my house. What are you, crazy? Well, if we're looking for an excuse, any excuse will do. Okay? Don't believe everything people say about the Bible. Faith is not based on feelings, it's based on fact. And if somebody wants an excuse not to believe the Bible, they'll find one. Okay? They'll find 10, whatever. But that doesn't mean you have to believe everything they say. If somebody wants an excuse, any excuse will do. Also, notice that self-centered people are harmful. And this is where we need to be wise. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, and your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles, and your princes feast at the proper time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hand, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. We know that this is one of the fatal flaws of power politics, that self-centered people are harmful. And again, a ruler is often put in place with the help of his friends, and then he has to bring his friends in. And pretty soon you've got self-centered people running the country, or the city, or the state. And Solomon's own son did this. Solomon's own son, he becomes king, and he's so self-centered and so unyielding that when the people come to him and they said, our burden is too heavy, would you lighten it for us? He goes to the older men who advised his father, Solomon, and he says, this is what the people are saying, what would you recommend here? And what they said was, your father was hard on the people, and they're crying out for help. And if you lighten their burden, they'll love you. They'll actually support you through your whole reign, and you'll have a very long reign. Well, he goes to the younger guys, the guys his age, and he says, what would you do in this situation? The people are saying that their burden's too heavy, and they said, you need to show them who's boss. You need to tell them that your pinky finger is bigger than your father's waist. Your father whipped them with whips. You're going to whip them with scorpions. And so that's what he decided to do. He told the people, you thought you had it hard then. You're going to have it really hard now, now that I'm king. It fractured the kingdom. It split and was never reunited because of that. Because of his pride. Self-centered people are harmful. Times have changed, but human nature stays the same. And any type of power goes to people's heads. I mean, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Whether it's communist China or Russia or even in the West. I saw this headline this week. The CCP, that is the China Communist Party, the CCP will kill as many as it has to kill to preserve its power. So says a historian. The article said that if you concentrate power over the lives of human beings in all domains, economic, political, educational, social, what you attract are the unscrupulous, the pathological, the sociopathological, explained history professor Alan Coors, citing economist and philosopher Friedrich Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom. What he was pointing out was power attracts a certain type of person. And the more power you concentrate over the people, the worse the people are going to be attracted to the power to rule. So you end up with sociopaths running these countries. And that's what happens. That's the way the system is built. It's the way it works. Self-centered people are harmful to others. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, whether it's in the realm of government or on the job or in the home. Self-centered people divide nations. They divide people. They divide families. They divide churches. Self-centered people are harmful. And that's just a fact of life. And we see that here. Anything you say or do can and will be held against you. Look at verse 20. Do not revile the king even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird in the sky may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. Do you notice this warning of wisdom? Under totalitarian regimes, we don't grasp this in the West. People blab their mouth about anybody over here. Nobody cares. But when you live under a totalitarian regime, what you say or do can and will be held against you by the state. I used to work with a Ukrainian, and at first we didn't get along. We didn't understand each other. But I got to know him, and we worked together for quite a while. I could not understand this guy. He was so pro-America, patriotic, conservative, but he was from the Ukraine, and I couldn't understand that. Well, come to find out, he grew up under the Soviet Union. He grew up behind the Iron Curtain before the Soviet Union fell. And he told me what it was like to live under there, and he said, your own neighbors turn you in. There's a whole system that your neighbors turn you in over anything, and they get bonus points by turning in their neighbors. But it's not just bonus points. If they don't turn in their neighbors, they get sent to the gulag. And so it's fear. Fear controls, and you do not say openly what you would say in the West. You can't do it. In fact, I met another coworker who grew up in the United Kingdom, in Britain. He says he wouldn't go back for the same reason. You cannot openly speak your mind without fear of repercussion. Well, that's how it is in the former Soviet Union. That's how it is in China. It's a system that's enthroned, enforced through surveillance, a surveillance state. And my Ukrainian friend told me he was bitter because of what he grew up under. And he had great bitterness for the Russian Orthodox Church. And I said, you know, why? They took the priests and they took them out and they replaced them with their own pro-communist puppet priests and hierarchy. And the priests were actually informants on their own parishioners. Priests turning in their own congregants to the state. It's just so sad. And I don't know what he's going through now. He doesn't live in Oregon anymore, but what's going on in the Ukraine now, I know, breaks his heart. There are Christian churches in Ukraine who are being persecuted. They're fleeing to the West. There are Christians in China who are being watched by a surveillance state, and it's so sad because the surveillance state that's built is through social media, communist social media, built by techno-billionaires from the Silicon Valley, Apple, Google, Microsoft. It's so sad. There is so much money that people want out of China, billions, 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 that they're willing to build surveillance state technology for them to oppress their own people as long as we make billions. And so anything you can or say, anything you say or do can and will be held against you by the state. A Russian billionaire, I just saw an interview, said that he said something openly, and it was on camera, and Putin was in the room, and he was just bringing up the fact that there's the Russian way of doing business, and then there's the West way of doing business. What are we going to do? And for that, he got 5 years in Siberia. He was a Russian billionaire. He was the head of the largest Russian oil company at the time. He's my age. Even Russian billionaires have to watch what they say. He was sent to the gulag for 5 years. He escaped afterwards to the West. And now people interview him about what it was like to have to deal with Putin. And so this is the context. Do not revile the king even in your thought, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird in the sky may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. Meaning, it's not just you who are going to get punished, it's your family. Under those regimes, it's not just It's not just you with the careless words who go to the gulag. Your whole family goes to the gulag. You're done. And somebody else gets your money. But I want to share something really, really, really precious. And that is that anything you say or do can be forgiven you by the God of the universe. Imagine that. Anything you've ever said or done can be forgiven you by the judge of the universe. How amazing is that? And yet we live in fear of people who can kill the body. What about God, who knows everything about us and yet still loves us? He still loves us. He wants to forgive us. He wants to help us. He wants us to be free from sin and shame and guilt and condemnation. And he sent Jesus to save us from our sins. It's just astonishing. He wants actually what's best for us. And he's the king of the universe. He doesn't have to manipulate anybody. What did Jesus say? And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. There is no other way to actually be free. Free from your past, free from your guilt, free from your condemnation, free from your fear. You can be free. Freer than you can be in any other sense of the word, in any other way in the world. When Jesus sets you free, you are free indeed. And then it's just a matter of us just walking in the light and just being thankful that he set us free. If we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and sing.